land research psychologist, working at the Autism Research Centre at the University of Cambridge. And she's going to go into a bit more detail about the validation of the instruments used in the survey. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm going to be talking more about the complexities of having to do this kind of research. So this is going to be, I guess, a kind of intellectual challenge for you to think about how you go about doing this sort of research in adults when there's very little validation of instruments for adults existing at the moment. So I'll be following directly from the kind of things that Terry has been starting with and going through some of the existing screening instruments and diagnostic tools that are available, talking a little bit about their limitations and about what needs to be done if we're considering trying to apply this to identification and assessment of adults in the population. We've obviously heard already from Terry that diagnosis in adults is a difficult process. There are not very many professionals working within the adult field who understand how autism presents in adults. So there's part of the process of having to do any kind of research involves potentially training those individuals. But I'll be talking a little bit more about the kind of difficulties that you face when you're trying to do assessments and diagnosis in adulthood versus childhood. I will be talking in a fair amount of detail about the standardized instruments and the fact that most of the instruments that exist for screening and diagnosis in autism at the moment are instruments that exist specifically for and were developed within childhood populations, at most adolescence. There are some tools that touch into adulthood, but to date, the majority of those have been validated with young adults, so adults in their kind of late teens, early 20s, possibly into their 30s. There are very, very few instruments that have been designed specifically for or validated with adults who are older than 30. And if you're going to do an epidemiological study or a prevalence study where you genuinely want to look at adulthood, you have to accept that adulthood doesn't stop at 30. I would totally agree with that. But it goes from 18 to maybe 100. And all of the top end, the majority of those guys, because most of them are over 30, are not being assessed at all, not being addressed by any kind of standardized instruments. And that's a huge gap that we have in our facility for identifying autism at the moment. And looking at some of the instruments, as I'll do in a moment, that have got some validation, because of the nature of how you validate instruments in a research process, most of the validation has happened within clinical samples. So in the majority of cases, it means you have someone that you already know has got autism. They've already got a diagnosis of autism. They happen to now be an adult. And you then use them to test your instrument to see if your instrument would identify them as having autism. But that's not going to work quite the same if you want to then take that tool and assume that you can just apply that to the general population and that it's going to pick up individuals who haven't already got the diagnosis. So it might work very well in terms of differentiating known cases of autism from typical controls, for example, but is it going to work with cases that are unknown with autism in exactly the same way? You can't make that assumption in a research project, so you need some kind of validation of the tool. So the kind of challenges that are faced in terms of developing tools and how you work with the validation process, the first challenge is the fact that there is no established diagnostic process for adults at all. So although in childhood we have, certainly in the UK, we have a very specific structure that you would go through in order to diagnose a child. There are certain individuals and professionals that they would definitely see. You would have a multidisciplinary team. They would get assessment from speech therapists. You would get assessment from psychologists, pediatricians. There would be assessments of motor skills and so forth. And it would go through a very structured sequence and use particular kinds of tools that have been designed for children. There is no matching process in adults. There's nothing out there that says, if you think an adult might have autistic spectrum disorder, this is the process you go through. And part of that is because there are no standardized tools in order to assess those adults when you are faced with them. Added into that, you have the fact that in adulthood you have a very complex clinical picture. I'm sure we're going to hear more about this in both Pat and Marsha's talks In the second half, but the kind of things that you might be faced with, if you have an individual in front of you who's, let's say, 45 years old, has not got a diagnosis of autism, nobody's yet suggested they may have autism, although they do, they've got that far, struggling in society, struggling in life without a diagnosis and without support. You often have comorbid depression, anxiety, you may have difficulties in adaptive skills, in life skills, in coping skills, which then muddy the water in terms of your diagnostic process, because many of those issues mask the symptoms of ASD or potentially make them look more severe than they are. And you have to kind of unpick which bit of what you're seeing is related to the autistic spectrum and which bit is a comorbidity that may look similar, features of which may look similar, like depression can look similar to autism, and which bit is genuinely ASD related. As we've already heard mentioned by Terry, the other problem that you have in doing any kind of adult assessment is that you often don't have any access to developmental history information. Now, the diagnostic criteria for a diagnosis of an autistic spectrum condition is that you know that the presence is that the condition has been present, that the symptomatology has been present from early childhood. However, your 45-year-old, 50-year-old, 60-year-old adult who's in front of you for an assessment may not have a living informant who can tell you about their early childhood. If they do have a living informant, the chances of that living informant accurately remembering what that person was like under the age of five in order to describe them is relatively slim. And you also have the added complexity that Terry has mentioned, that when you're working with adults, you need the permission from the adult to be able to talk to an informant anyway in order to elicit that information. There are some processes, certainly some clinics that that I am aware of and work alongside, where diagnosis is not done on an individual where there is no early developmental history informant to provide that information. So there's a huge cohort of adults who potentially are not permitted to be given an assessment for a diagnosis of autism simply on the basis that there's no other person who can give information about their childhood, which seems really quite frightening. And I think, again, is another evidence of the need for validation of instruments that are specifically targeting this population. The other difficulty that you have in adulthood is that characteristics of other psychiatric conditions that are commonly seen in adulthood are very similar in appearance to characteristics that you see in elements of autistic spectrum disorder. Take, for example, negative symptoms of schizophrenia, where you have someone who may have a very flat affect and very flat facial expressions. That looks very similar to the flat affect and flat use of facial expression that you might see in the autistic spectrum. Individuals who have obsessive compulsive disorders may be confused with the intense obsessive circumscribed interest that you see in an individual with Asperger syndrome. I could go on into huge amounts of detail, I won't, about the overlaps, but there are many different psychiatric characteristics in different psychiatric disorders and conditions that look similar to ASD, and being able to accurately tell the difference between them is very important, hence the need for valid instruments that can do that job. And I've mentioned already that some adults who've got to that stage in life without any kind of support or any kind of diagnosis often have developed strategies of their own. The family may have developed strategies to support them, and those strategies can hide some of the difficulties. I'm going to mention at the end of this talk women. I will come back to women because I do think that we miss female presentation because of the strategies that women with ASD use to mask their social impairment. And I think that a lot of the standardized instruments that we have at the moment not only were designed originally with children in mind, but were also designed focusing on the male presentation of autism and therefore run the risk of missing the females. So screening tools specifically designed for adults are rare. However, there are a couple that are in existence. We've heard about Simon Baron Cohen's autism quotient, which a version of which was used in the population study that Terry talked about. It's used increasingly. There's a lot of work done on looking at its validity and its reliability. However, it's hasn't been used until the study that Terry was talking about. It was had never been used within a general population. And something that we did find in that study is that it didn't work very well as a screening instrument when you apply it in the general population. Part of the reason for that was because of the age of the adults who are in the general population. We're talking about individuals who are, as we've said, maybe up to their 70s or 80s. Some of the items that are asked about in an instrument like the AQ focus on the kind of social relationships and social activities that individuals are engaged in, and we were getting false positives from older adults who were saying, no, I wouldn't rather go to a party than the theatre, and no, I don't see my friends very often, and I don't have very many friends, mostly in brackets because they are all now deceased, but the question doesn't ask about that. And so we were getting false positive scores of individuals who were older adults because they don't have the kind of social life that the expectation is of an instrument that's been focused on younger adults. So quite a few of the individuals who were screened in the and had the ADOS done were rather lovely little old ladies who would instantly offer the examiners who were coming in buns and cups of tea, and definitely didn't have an autistic spectrum disorder, but thoroughly enjoyed the entire process because it was the first time they'd seen someone for about 3 months, I think, and they didn't. It was very difficult to leave. But I think it highlights the issue about the fact that there is, within the research field, we have a kind of assumption that if you've done a bit of research where you've taken an instrument or you've done it in a proportion of the adult population, that somehow it's naturally going to apply to the entire population. And certainly we didn't find that with the AQ. So I do think that there are some concerns from us, from our study, about how well the instrument would work in the older adult population. It may work fine in younger adults. Chris Gilberg and Nylander have developed the adult Asperger and Autistic Spectrum Disorder screening questionnaire, which is specifically targeted for adults who have high-functioning autism or Asperger syndrome presentation, and there is some validation data on this instrument. However, this one is used specifically by adult psychiatrists within adult services. It's a very brief instrument, and therefore it requires that the person has already been referred into services and you think they might have an autistic spectrum disability, and you then provide this questionnaire to see whether that warrants further diagnostic exploration. So in terms of a prevalence study, it's not any use because we want something that's screening at an earlier stage than actual referral into clinic settings. Outside of that, those are the only two screening instruments that I am aware of that are specifically developed for adults. There are a few diagnostic tools that have been devised with adults in mind, the newest of which, and the one which I think at the moment is showing the most promise, is RITVO's Asperger and Autism Diagnostic Scale Revised, which is a self-report interview-style questionnaire, but it's completed within a clinic, so there's a clinician sitting there who can help the adult in terms of clarification of what the questions are. So they're not sitting at home filling it in and not understanding what it's asking about. And there's some quite good data on that. RITVO's latest publication shows almost 800 adults being assessed with the RADS, including adults with autism, Asperger's, and other kinds of psychiatric presentations, and it was very good in terms of differentiating the autistic spectrum disorder presentations from other psychiatric presentations in adults. Chris Gilberg's Asperger syndrome diagnostic interview is thought to be able to be used within adolescents and older and adults, but again, not widely used in the older adult population. It tends to be the younger adult population. And there are often debates about some of these instruments that Chris Gilberg has devised simply because Chris's diagnostic ideas about Asperger syndrome are a little bit different to what's in the current manuals at the time. So it's his idea of Asperger, which may not necessarily sit alongside DSM and ICD criteria for Asperger and autistic spectrum disorders. We also have the AAA, which is Simon Baron Cohen's adult Asperger assessment, which he uses in his adult clinic in Cambridgeshire. And this is a sort of structured interview done with the individual themselves, but always with an informant who can talk about that person as a young child as well. And it cannot be done without the presence of a third-party informant who can talk about early childhood. So individuals will not be seen for AAA assessments if they cannot provide a third-party informant who can talk about them in early childhood. So it negates most of the individuals that we would have seen in our population who don't have third-party informants. We wouldn't have been able to use that as an instrument. We also obviously used the ADOS. We wanted a direct observational assessment And this is the best known tool and the most validated instrument that exists out there. I'm going to go through it a little bit for those of you who don't know what the ADOS is, but it's basically a standardized and semi-structured observational assessment that covers childhood into adulthood. Module 4, the top module, is the one that is used for verbally fluent individuals from adolescence upwards, although, as mentioned, the validation data focuses mostly on adolescents and young adults and not older adults. And in this particular survey, we were looking at verbally fluent individuals. We are, as Terry mentioned, following this up with a study that's looking at non-verbal and severely learning disabled or intellectually impaired adults, which is even more challenging, I have to say. So there's very little validation data since the very original study in the early development of the ADOS, or the ADOS generic as now published by WPS, the 2000 version, which we now use clinically and in research. That's the latest validation data that there was on Module 4, and that was in a very small sample of young adults. And again, it was done in a clinic setting, so it was adults who had a known diagnosis of autistic spectrum disorder, and seeing with the ADOS could differentiate them from adults who didn't have ASD. There has been a very good recent paper published by Bastiansen in 2010 where she looked at validity data in a clinical sample comparing individuals with autistic spectrum disorder with psychosis, with schizophrenia, and with typically developing individuals on the Module 4 of the ADOS. She found that the ADOS worked well at differentiating ASD from psychosis, and typical development, but it wasn't so good at differential diagnosis between ASD and schizophrenia. So there was quite a lot of overlap in terms of individuals presenting with schizophrenia also scoring on the ADOS. Although some preliminary work looking at using the new proposals of DSM-5, where we include the repetitive and stereotype behaviours in the ADOS, because at the moment, the existing version of the ADOS does not require the presence of repetitive and stereotype behaviours for a classification of ASD on the basis that you might not see them in a one-hour semi-structured setting. Bastiansen found that if you did incorporate that, then it was able to differentiate ASD and schizophrenia. But I'm going to come back to that when I talk a little bit more about what happened in our study with the general population. So as Terry's mentioned, there's been no validation at all done with the ADOS in the general population until just recently. Any kind of tool that you want to use for prevalence and epidemiology studies for screening of possible presentation of ASD in a population requires that that screening instrument can be used in the general population. And a lot of screening instruments are not designed for that. They're designed to be used in clinic settings, not within the general population as a whole. And there's very little general population validity data on many screening tools. And when you get to the stage of within a prevalence study of trying to identify the cases, you need to get as good sensitivity and specificity as possible from a research perspective, because you want your research findings to be as robust as they can be. However, when you're doing general population screening, you need to be as sensitive as possible, and that often comes at a cost of specificity. So in order to pick up as many cases as possible, you often mean that you also scoop up a lot of false positives that you've got to work your way through in order to make sure that you've got all the cases that you should be detecting. And of course, those of you who work in research will know that within a research setting, you have to use a standardized instrument. You will not get your articles published in any journals if you do not use standardized diagnostic tools, which is intensely challenging if you're trying to do work in a field where the tools have not been validated, because you're starting from scratch. So we had a go at validating the ADOS with our population. So obviously, as you've seen, this is quite a small number of individuals. Although we did over 600 ADOS assessments, ultimately the number of cases that we identified was quite low. So this is kind of preliminary information, really, that needs to be replicated in other contexts. And as Terry said, over 7,000 adults initially, and 618 of those completed the ADOS. Although, as I mentioned earlier, some of those may have been screen positives on the AQ because they were little elderly ladies who were desperate for some company. So not all 618 really had such a high risk for ASD as might have been suggested by the screening tool. What we did, because the ADOS Module 4, as it stands, is argued not to be very good at picking up the more subtle presentations of autistic spectrum disorders, we spent a lot of time training our clinical interviewers on what the milder presentation of autistic spectrum disorder would look like in individuals who are living in the community. So we roped in a load of volunteers who have a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome in particular, who are living independently. They may have partners, they have jobs, they may have families. So we are talking about the most subtle end of the scale, and got our examiners to practice ADOS administration with those individuals so that they could get the experience of what someone who's both ASD positive and within the community may present like. We hope that that helped in terms of the way that the ADOS worked. It meant asking some of the questions in a little bit more detail than just what's written on the schedule. So, for example, in the ADOS schedule, you have questions about what is a friend. We didn't just ask what is a friend. We would go into quite a lot of detail about and how often do you see these friends and what made you have relationships with these people and what's the difference between someone who's a friend and someone who's just an acquaintance and how long are you supposed to know someone before they move from an acquaintance to a friend, so that we could get a real feel for what their level of understanding was relative to what you would expect in the general population. So it's a little different because it's not relative to what you'd expect in a clinical sample like most of the other studies. We did find, I did a poster on this yesterday, so I won't do too much information, but we certainly found that the ADOS Module 4 existing thresholds for ASD and autism worked quite well. Autism threshold, the 10-plus cutoff on the existing ADOS, works the best if you want to be sure that it's just ASD. But if you want to increase your sensitivity and pick up everybody, you're better with the lower threshold of 7-plus. Which means you're going to get a lot of false positives, but you at least increase the chance of picking up the lower number, all of the cases. There are ongoing challenges that do not exist at the moment in terms of work for adult assessment. We do not have any validated tools at all for adults who have intellectual impairments and low levels of independent functioning. So the project that we're doing at the moment is fraught with difficulty because we're effectively having to invent the way that we assess an adult who has intellectual impairment as in residential care, because there is no existing validated instrument for that. We've talked about the difficulty of unpicking the differential diagnosis within adults, trying to get that balance between getting all the cases but not being too over-inclusive of false positives. And a challenge that we have coming up imminently are the changes in diagnostic criteria. DSM-5 is going to change how we identify autistic spectrum disorder, and some of the standardized instruments, like the ADOS, are already changing their process and their algorithms in order to reflect the new criteria, which means for anyone who's going to do any kind of replication of this work, they have to make the decision as to whether they're going to do the same process that we've done or whether they're going to use the new tools. And if they use the new tools, would a different result be the result of using a different instrument? So it's very difficult in these sorts of settings to work like that. Presentation of women. Terry mentioned the fact that we didn't get very many females. I think we didn't get very many females because there are no instruments that have been validated in the female presentation of ASD. And I've spoken clinically with a lot of females with ASD diagnoses who do not like the existing instruments because they are targeted at males and they do not pick up the quality of what is presenting for women. So a huge gap in our services at the moment and in our research at the moment is not having standardized measures for assessing women with ASD. So my summary is that we can use standardized instruments, but they must be validated appropriately within the population that you're going to work with. And that often means you're starting from scratch with these instruments. Getting the balance between a valid clinical diagnosis and what's seen as valid in an instrument is also difficult. If we put the threshold for the diagnosis on the instrument as our requirement for identification, then that is more specific but less sensitive in the population. So ultimately, researchers have to understand that there are limitations in being tied to standardized tools, as well as the benefits of having appropriate standardized methodology to use in this research. Thank you.
So we've got about 5 minutes for questions now. If people would like to come up to the microphone to put questions. Terry and her name's gone out of my head. You'll both answer questions.
Hi. It seems like there's a real risk here of over-pathologizing a general adult population in terms of symptoms or characteristics that may reflect lower social motivation or just social differences, but not really ASD. And I'm wondering how much we should factor in level of functional impairment true clinical level of impairment when we're thinking about how to characterize prevalence or when we're thinking about what kind of an impact this disorder is really having on an adult population. And so I know you're already looking at the very, very high end of the spectrum in these studies, only verbally fluent adults, which is a very small percentage of our group. But how do you think we should factor in what level of impairment it's causing you in your daily life compared to how you present in terms of symptoms?
That's a very good question. I think one of the things that we found that was noted on my poster yesterday is that if you look at the number of individuals who identified by the ADOS thresholds, it was much higher than the number of individuals that clinical consensus with the... We had six clinicians looking at all of the available information and making judgments on whether or not the person met the criteria for ASD. That was much, much more conservative than the instruments were. And I think that reflects exactly what you're saying, that in clinical practice, people don't make a diagnosis just because there's the presence of ticks in the box of the potential characteristics of ASD. You need not just to have that kind of personality, you need to actually have an impairment that warrants a clinical assessment and a clinical classification. I think what's difficult with instruments is getting that balance between having an instrument that picks up all of the cases that matter, but doesn't leave out the ones that actually that are having difficulties but are not presenting because they may not have the core characteristics. Women, for example, I think often under-present in terms of symptomatology and yet can have huge difficulties in terms of coping and living situations. And I think that we're missing the struggles that they have because we're not identifying them in the first place and they're being excluded from any kind of assessment or research projects.
Thank you.
Very interesting talks, thanks. I'm just curious if, given the social nature of a door-to-door survey-based interaction, wouldn't individuals who might be on the spectrum but not be aware of that diagnosis automatically self-select themselves out?
Well, we did look at this. If you read our paper in the Archives of General Psychiatry out this month, we were able to do some analyses looking at the likelihood that people with ASD would be more or less cooperative. And you'll see there that there were a couple of analyses we were able to run, sensitivity analyses, if you like, which didn't really support that. And we've also looked at the literature from epidemiological research across mental disorders in adulthood, and there isn't any consistent evidence of bias one way or the other in terms of the prevalence of the condition.
One other quick question. Could you improve your efficiency if you only selected households by census data, for example, that have one individual?
Well, I suppose it's something we could look at because we know which households had just one individual. But perhaps that's something we discuss afterwards.
What do you think the prospects are of neuroimaging or like DTI being used as a diagnostic tool or a validating tool?
Well, I was asked to comment on a recent paper which was due out sometime last year on that very question. Obviously, that's not practical in this sort of study, so I'm not sure that it's really terribly relevant to what we're talking about here. But I think that's a piece of research that is quite important because it shows that at least a step forward is made. But I think we've very very long way to go before we can actually have methods like that can replace clinical evaluations.
Yeah. If I can add to that, I also I worry a little bit about the assumption that screening someone and saying that their brain looks like they're autistic therefore means that they warrant a diagnosis or indeed have any need for support or not. Going back to the question we had earlier about the sort of clinical need, I think it's entirely possible that there are individuals who absolutely would have a brain scan that says they're on the autistic spectrum but who don't have a clinical need for that. Plus, it also... it kind of assumes that if you identify the person as being autistic, that's it then. And that, and we, I know as a psychologist that actually what matters is not the yes or no to autism. What matters is that individual person's level of functioning and difficulties with which they're facing and how you can then develop strategies to support them. So I don't think that a neurological screener would be able to kind of wipe out the need for any other more detailed psychological assessment of function and need in an individual. It would simply potentially make the yes or no bit a little bit faster, but you'd still need all the rest.
I would just add that that's also true for conditions like epilepsy and dementia.
I think we're going to have to leave it to two questions, so just the last two people.
I'm from the University of Pennsylvania, where we're also actually doing prevalence studies with adults. But I was wondering if you thought about using the SRSA with this population, or if you could speak to its validity at all?
Certainly, looking at the research that's been done linking the work with the RADS and the SRSA being used in conjunction, it looks like a very promising tool that could be used. It wasn't one that we used, obviously, in our research, but we're certainly thinking about looking at alternatives in ongoing research that we're talking about, and we've been talking about maybe a study looking at the RADS in the UK, because at the moment it's not widely used there. And we, you know, we are always actively looking for better instruments. So, yeah.
I had, excuse me, two questions. One related to the issue of the challenges of the current instruments for women, and if you could, you've spoken a little bit to that, but a little more detail would be helpful. And the second issue was related to your surprising prevalence numbers in adults and thinking about the implications of that for treatment in terms of much of the treatment, I wonder, focuses more on the sequelae of mental health issues as opposed to developmental disability issues. And can you speak, and maybe it's early days on this, but do we need to think about how we consider interventional issues for adults?
I think it would take a long time to go into all the specifics about female presentation, but I would certainly very briefly say that if we take the ADOS as an instrument in example, the ADOS works on the basis of looking for characteristics in a face-to-face interaction. And some of those characteristics are things like whether or not the person makes eye contact, whether they use gesture, whether they have appropriate facial expressions. These are the kinds of things that often women have learned how to do. They're very good at... I've met many women with ASD who are very good at